he thinks. The door lock clicks open. So that's new, but he'll process it later. What the? Says the woman inside, as Manny tosses his bag onto the back seat and climbs in after it. She's a very young white woman, so young that she doesn't look old enough to drive, who has twisted around to stare at him. But she's mostly indignant rather than scared, which seems a good starting place for their future relationship. Hey, dude, this isn't a real cab. It's just an antique, a prop. People rent it for weddings. Manny pulls the door shut. FTR, please, he says, and flashes his most charming smile. It shouldn't work. She should be screaming her head off and trying to get the nearest cop to shoot him. But something else has occurred between them, helping to keep the woman calm. Manny has followed to the letter the ritual of getting in a cab, introducing enough plausible deniability that she thinks he's deluded rather than a potential threat. However, there's power in what he's done that goes beyond just psychology. He's felt it before, hasn't he? Just a moment ago, when he somehow drew strength from the chaos of 7th Avenue to ease the pain in his side. He can actually hear some of that power whispering to her, maybe he's an actor. He looks like that guy whose name you can't remember from that musical you like. So maybe don't freak out yet. Because New Yorkers don't freak out around famous people. And how does he know all this? Because he does, that's how. He's trying to keep up. So he adds, after a breath passes and she just stares, "You're going that way anyway, aren't you?" She narrows her eyes at him. They're at a red light, but the walk sign nearby is blinking. He's got maybe 10 more seconds. "How the hell did you know that?" "Because the cab wouldn't have stopped if you weren't," he doesn't say, and reaches for his wallet. "Here," he says, handing her a $100 bill. She stares at it, then her lip curls. "Right, a fake." "I have 20s if you'd prefer." There's more power in 20s anyway. A lot of businesses in the city won't take hundreds, also for fear of counterfeit bills. With 20s, Manny will be able to compel her to take him where he needs to go, whether she wants to or not. He'd rather persuade, though. Force is... he doesn't want to use force. "Tourists do carry a lot of cash," she murmurs while frowning, as if reasoning with her better instincts. "And you don't look like a serial killer." "Most serial killers take care to look like ordinary people," he points out. "Not helping your case with the mansplaining guy." "Good point, sorry." That seems to decide her. "Well, assholes don't say sorry." She considers for a moment longer. "Make that 2 Benjis, and okay." He offers the 20s, although he does have another $100 bill in his wallet. There's no need to use the bills for power anymore, however. She has completed the ritual by accepting his directions, then performed the orthogonal ritual of haggling for more money. All the stars have aligned. She's on board. As she's pocketing the money, the traffic light changes and a car immediately honks behind her. She casually flips that driver off, and then wrenches the wheel to drag the cab across 4 active lanes, as if she's done this or driven the Daytona 500 all her life. And that's that. Even Manny is amazed at how well this strange power works as he hangs onto the door handle and the ancient lap-only seatbelt and tries not to look alarmed by her driving. He has some inkling of why it works. Money talks and bullshit walks in New York. In a lot of cities, probably. But here, the nation's shrine to unrestricted predatory capitalism, money has nearly talismanic power, which means that he can use it as a talisman. The traffic lights miraculously stay in their favor for several blocks, which is fortunate, because the young woman is likely to break the sound barrier at this rate. Then she curses and slams on the brakes as a light ahead makes a fast switch to red. Too fast. Amazing that she doesn't run the light. He smells a waft of burnt rubber through the open window as he leans forward to squint at the light. Busted light? Must be, she says, tapping her fingertips rapidly on the wheel. This, Manny knows, is a gesture required by the ritual of hurry up, damn it. But it doesn't work, because that ritual never works. They usually line up better than this. Just one light out of sequence can start a traffic jam. Manny presses his hand against the cold, spreading ache in his side that is beginning to throb again. Something about the traffic light has pinged his new sense of wrongness. And the wrongness is enough to erode whatever anesthetic effect he's managed to summon. He opens his mouth to suggest that she run the light, which is risky. The wrongness has probably weakened his influence on her, too. And now there's nothing to stop her from thinking twice about this strange black dude in her antique cab. But whatever is happening on the east side of the island, FDR Drive, is growing urgent. He can't risk getting kicked out of the cab until he gets there. Before Manny can speak, however, a BMW passes through the intersection ahead. There are long, feathery white tendrils growing from its wheel wells. He watches it go past in utter shock. The driver sees it too. Her mouth falls open. Feathery doesn't quite fit what they're seeing. It's more like an anemone's fronds or the tendrils of certain jellyfish. As the car rolls by, gliding along behind a slower driver, they see one of the tendrils seem to inhale. It opens itself out a little, revealing a thickened stalk that tapers as it stretches away from the wheels up to slightly darkened tips. All of it is translucent. Not all of it is here. In this world, that is. Manny sees at once that it is like the dual city. Here, but also in that other place where the sky is wild and people are a never thought. All of that is academic, though, because in the next moment, Manny notices something that makes the little hairs on the back of his neck stand up. The tendrils twitch as the BMW thumps over a pothole, but it's not the pothole that they're reacting to. They're longer, see, turning, like some kind of wiggly, worm-like radio antennas, stretching toward the checker cab, as if they sense Manny inside and smell his fear. After the BMW moves on, its driver apparently oblivious. It takes a moment for Manny's skin to stop crawling. So you saw that too, right? Asks the driver. The traffic light has finally changed. They speed toward FDR again. Nobody else was staring but you. Her eyes meet his in the rear view. Yeah, he says. Yeah, I saw it. Yeah. It occurs to him belatedly that she might need more explanation than this if he doesn't want to get kicked out of the cab. You're not crazy, or at least if you are, you're not the only one. Oh, well, that's comforting. She licks her lips. Why couldn't anyone else see it? I wish I knew. But when she shakes her head, he feels compelled to add, we're going to destroy the thing that's causing it. He means it to reassure, but he also realizes as he says it that it's true. He doesn't let himself think further about how he knows it's true. He doesn't ask whom the we in his statement refers to. They're too far into this now. If he starts doubting himself here, that will weaken the power, and more importantly, he'll start questioning his own sanity. Then they're back to involuntary commitment. Destroy what? She's frowning as she looks at him in the rear view this time. He doesn't want to admit that he doesn't know. Just get me to FDR and I'll handle it. Much to his relief, she relaxes and flashes a lopsided smile over her shoulder. Weird, but okay. The grandkids are gonna love this story if I, you know, have grandkids. She drives on. Then at last they're on the FDR drive, moving faster toward that vague but rapidly sharpening sense of wrongness. Manny is clinging to the old-fashioned leather handle sewn into the seat back before him, because she's still doing the race car driver act, whipping around slower cars and cresting hills with enough speed that it feels a little like riding the cyclone. What is a roller coaster? But they're getting closer to the source of all the trouble. There's a knot of small aircraft over and boats crowding along the nearby East River, all of them generally centering on something farther south. All Manny can see from here is smoke. Maybe it has to do with that bridge incident you heard about on the train. Must be. They've begun to pass signs warning of delays, detours, and police activity below Houston Street. But it's also clear that they're much closer to the wrongness than to the bridge disaster. Now they're passing more cars over on the uptown side of FDR that seem to be infested with the weird white tendrils. Most are growing from the wheels, same as on the Beamer they saw before. It's as if the cars have rolled over something noxious that's allowed a kind of metaphysically opportunistic infection at the site of the damage. A few vehicles have it in their front grills or curling up from their undercarriages. One car, a newish Beetle, has the tendrils in a spray up one door and crawling over the driver's window. The driver doesn't notice. What will happen if it touches her when she opens the door? Nothing good. Then the traffic slows sharply, and the city's second unseen disaster comes into range. His first thought is that it's like an explosion, kind of. Imagine a fountain bursting up from the asphalt and flaring 20 or 30 feet into the sky and wiggling. In lieu of water, the fountain flares with tendrils, dozens of them, anemonaic and enormous. Some writhe together in a way that is both mesmerizing and vaguely phallic as they tower above the roofs of the cars. Manny can tell that the root of the growth is located somewhere up ahead on the downtown side, probably in the fast lane, which must be how it's getting so many cars on the uptown going side, despite the median barrier. He sees a shiny new SUV with Pennsylvania plates pass that is so covered in the tendrils that it looks like a spectral hedgehog. Good thing the driver can't see them, or his vision would be too occluded to allow driving. But an ancient, rusty Ford Escort with missing hubcaps and peeling paint comes right behind it, and the tendrils haven't touched it at all. What's the pattern? He can't begin to guess. This explosion of ick is what's causing the traffic jam, Manny sees, as the flow of cars slows to a crawl, and the checker comes to a near halt. Although most people can't see the flare of tendrils, they're still somehow reacting to its presence. Drivers in the fast lane keep trying to pull into the middle lane to get around the thing. Drivers in the middle are trying to get into the right-hand lane to get around them, and drivers in the right-hand lane aren't budging. It's as if there's an invisible accident up ahead that everyone's trying to avoid. Thank God it's not rush hour, or the traffic wouldn't be moving at all. They've stopped for a moment, so Manny opens the rear passenger side door to get out. A few of the cars behind him immediately set up a banshee chorus of horns, protesting even the possibility that he might slow things down more. But he ignores these and leans over to speak into the window when the driver rolls it down. She has to lean across the seat and turn a manual crank to do this. For a moment, he stares in fascination, then focuses. "You got emergency flares?" he asks. "Triangle reflector, stuff like that?" "In the trunk." She puts the car in park and gets out herself, There are more horns at this, but she's glancing over at the tower of tendrils. Its tips wave above the pedestrian bridge that crosses this part of the FDR.
So that's what this is all about.
Yep. Manny pulls out the emergency kit when she opens the trunk. He's keeping most of his attention on the thing, though. If any of those tendrils come at them, well, hopefully they won't.
You better hurry and do whatever you're going to do. Cops are probably already on the way to deal with the, obstruction. I don't know if they'll see it. Nobody else seems to. Or a lot more people would be getting out of their cars and walking. But they're not going to help much.
He grimaces in agreement. Then he notices the way she's glaring at the fountain of tendrils. He has a tiny epiphany, beginning to understand.
You from here?
She blinks.
Yeah. Born and raised right over in Chelsea, two moms and everything. Why?
Just a guess. Manny hesitates. He's feeling strange again. There are things happening around him, to him. A rise in tension and power and meaning. All of it pulling toward a moment of truth that he's not sure he wants to confront. Beneath his feet, there is a vibration. A pulse like wheels clacking steadily over track segments that thrums in time with his pulse. Why? Because it does. Because somehow, everything on this road and under it and around it is him. The pain in his side is awful, but ignorable because somehow the city is keeping him functioning, feeding him strength. Even the idling of the traffic-bound cars feeds him, pent energy just waiting for its chance to leap ahead. He looks around at the drivers in the nearby cars and sees that most are glaring at the tendril thing, too. Do they see it? Not really. But they know something is there, blocking the flow of the city, and they hate it for that alone. This is how it works. He realizes in wonder, this is what he needs to defeat the tendrils. These total strangers are his allies. Their anger, their need for a return to normalcy, rises from them like heat waves. This is the weapon he needs if he can figure out how to harness it. I'm Manny, he says to the cab driver on impulse. You? She looks surprised, then grins.
Madison, she says.
I know, but number one mom says I got conceived via IVF in a clinic just off Madison, so... Too much information, Manny chuckles anyway, because he's all nerves and could use a laugh. Okay, here's the plan, he says. Then he lays it out for her. She stares at him like he's crazy. But she'll help. He can see that in her face. Fine, she says at last, but it's just a show of reluctance. Maybe New Yorkers don't like to be seen as too helpful. They lay out the flares and triangle markers to encourage people to go around the fast lane. Because the cab isn't moving, angry commuters glare and honk as they pass, assuming that the cab is somehow making the traffic worse. It probably is. One guy starts screaming at Manny loudly enough to spray the inside of his door window with spittle, though fortunately he's also too angry to remember to roll the window down first. It's a measure of how much everyone is picking up on the weirdness, though, that no one veers back into the fast lane even after they pass the parked checker cab. The mass of tendrils is growing as Manny watches. There is a low, crumbly sound that he can hear from that direction now and again when the wind carries it to him. Probably the sound of roots digging into asphalt, and probably into the rebar within the asphalt, and maybe into the bedrock that's under the road. He can hear the tendrils too, now that they're close enough. A choppy, broken groan, stuttering, and occasionally clicking like a corrupted music file. He can smell it. A thicker, much fishier brine scent than that of the nearby East River. Trimethylamine oxide. He thinks, out of the blue, the scent of the deep, cold, crushing ocean depths. What now? Madison asks. I need to hit it. Manny looks around before spotting exactly what he needs. There, in a convertible sports car's open back seat. The Indian woman driving it stares at him in blatant curiosity. He steps toward her quickly and blurts, Hey, can I have that umbrella?
How about pepper spray? She suggests.
He holds up his hands to try to look less threatening, though he's still a 6-foot-tall, not white guy, and some people are just never going to be okay with that. If you loan it to me, I can clear this traffic jam. At this, she actually looks intrigued.
Huh. Well, for that, I guess I can give up an umbrella. It's my sister's anyway. I just like to hit people with it.
She grabs the umbrella and hands it to him, pointy tip first. Thanks. He grabs it and trots back to the cab. Okay, we're golden. Madison frowns at him, then at the tendril flare as she opens the cab's driver's side door to get back in.
I can't see what's beyond that thing, she says. If there are cars and I can't brake in time.
Yeah, I know. Manny vaults up onto the checker's hood, then its roof. Madison stares while he turns and arranges himself to sit straddling the roof, one hand gripping the off-duty sign. Fortunately, checkers are high and long, narrow built for city streets. He can get enough of a grip with his legs to hold on, though it's still going to be dicey. Okay, ready.
I am so texting my weed man as soon as this is over, Madison says, shaking her head as she gets into the cab.
The umbrella is key. Manny doesn't know why, but he's okay with accepting what he can't quite understand for now. What's really bothering him is that he's not sure how to use it. Given that everything in him cries out that the forest of tendrils is dangerous, deadly if it so much as touches him, maybe because the tendrils look like anemones, which sting their prey to death, he needs to figure it out fast. As Madison starts up the cab, he experimentally lifts the umbrella, metal tip pointing toward the tendril mass like a jouster's lance. It's wrong. The right idea, but the wrong implementation. Weak, somehow. The umbrella's an automatic, so he unsnaps its closure and presses the button. It pops open at once, and it's huge. A golf umbrella, a nice one. With no hint of a rattle or wobble as Madison accelerates and the wind pulls at the umbrella. But still wrong. The tendril mass looms, ethereal and pale, more frightening as the cab accelerates. There is a beauty to it, he must admit, like some haunting bioluminescent deep-sea organism dragged to the surface. It is an alien beauty, however, meant for some other environment, some other ether. And here in New York, its presence is a contaminant. The very air around it has turned gray, and now that they're closer, he can hear the air hissing, as if the tendrils are somehow hurting the molecules of nitrogen and oxygen they touch. Manny's been in New York for less than an hour, and yet he knows, that cities are organic, dynamic systems. They are built to incorporate newness. But some new things become part of a city, helping it grow and strengthen, while some new things can tear it apart. They're speeding now, doing at least 50. The tendrils shadow the sky, and the air has turned cold, and the smell of lightless oceans has grown nauseating, and it's getting hard to hold on to the cab's roof. He hangs on anyway and half shuts his eyes against the wind and the burning salt of the thing's scent, and what is he doing? Pushing out the interloper? But he's an interloper too, isn't he? And if he doesn't do this exactly the right way, then only one of the interlopers here is going to walk away from this confrontation intact. And the umbrella isn't strong enough. Then, when the checker is only feet away, close enough that Manny can see the slick, pore-flecked skin of the tendrils, and his side screams with agony like someone's jabbed an ice-cold pike through him, he remembers the words of the woman who gave him the umbrella. I just like to hit people with it, she'd said. Manny lets go of the off-duty sign. Immediately, he starts to slide back on the cab's roof because they're going so fast that he can barely hold on with his legs alone.
but he might survive falling off the cab. He won't survive contact with the nest of tendrils if he doesn't get this umbrella up. He needs both hands for that, wrestling against the wind and his own fear. But in the welter of seconds that he has, he manages to lift the open umbrella above his head. Now he might die, but at least his hair won't get wet in any sudden rain shower. Suddenly there is energy around him, in him, blazing rusty red and tarnished silver and green, bronze, and a thousand colors more. It has become a sheath around the whole cab, a sphere of pure energy, brightening enough to compete with the June midday sunlight, and in its suddenly loud song, Manny hears the horns of a thousand cars trapped on the FDR. The hissing air is eclipsed by the shouted road rage of hundreds of mouths. As he opens his mouth to shout with them, his cry is delight and the ecstasy of suddenly knowing that he isn't an interloper. The city needs newcomers. He belongs here as much as anyone born and bred to its streets, because anyone who wants to be of New York can be. He is no tourist, exploiting and gawking and giving nothing but money back. He lives here now. That makes all the difference in the world. So as Manny laughs, giddy with this realization and the power that now suffuses him, they strike the tendril mass. The sheath of energy surrounding the cab burns through it like a checkered missile. Of course, the cab is part of the power. That is why the city sent it to him. Manny feels the umbrella snag on something, and he clings tighter to it, rudely not lifting it or moving it aside because, I'm walking here, I have the right of way. And he's playing metaphysical sidewalk chicken with this violent, invasive tourist. Then they're through. Manny hears Madison yell from the inside of the cab as they get through the mass and see that there's a line of stopped cars dead ahead. She slams the brakes. Manny loses his grip on the umbrella as he frantically grabs for the off-duty sign, catching it even as his whole body flips onto the windshield and hood. The cab spins out as Madison throws the wheel. Now, instead of flying forward, he's being thrown around by centrifugal force. In his panic, he loses his grip on the sign and doesn't know how he finds the strength to grab for the edge of the hood below the wipers, even as his legs come loose and most of his body flies free in the direction of the stopped traffic. If the cab flips, he's dead. If he loses his grip and gets tossed onto the hatchback up ahead, he's dead. If he falls off the cabin under the wheels... But the cab finally skids to a halt, a bare inch away from the stopped car up ahead. Manny's feet thump onto the hatchback's trunk, not entirely of his own volition. It's okay. Just nice to have something solid under his feet again. Get your feet off my fucking car! Someone inside shouts. He ignores them. Holy shit! Madison sticks her head out the window, her face panicky like how he feels. Holy, are you okay? Yeah. Manny's honestly not sure, but he musters the wherewithal to sit up and look back down the fast lane. Behind them, the tendril forest has gone wild, its fronds whipping and flailing like a dying thing. It is dying. Where they punched through its thicket of roots, there is a checker cap cut out like something from a kid's cartoon, complete with an umbrella-shaped hole on top of its roof and a hunched human silhouette underneath. The edges of the cutout glow as if hot, and the fire rapidly eats its way outward and upward, fast as a circle of flame burning through a piece of paper. Within seconds, this burn has eaten its way through the base of the tendrils, then starts burning all the way up. No ash or residue remains in the wake of this process. Manny knows this is because the tendrils aren't really there, aren't really real in any way that makes sense. The destruction is real, however. Once the last of the tendrils has burned away, a hovering, brightly colored knot of energy, the remnant of the sheath that surrounded the cab, now a wild, seething thing of its own, dissipates in a miniature explosion that ripples concentrically outward. Manny shudders as the wave of light and color and heat passes through him. He knows it won't hurt,
but he's surprised when it warms the place on his side that hurt so badly before.
All better now.
More dramatically, tendrils that have attached themselves to the nearby cars wither away the instant the energy hits them. He feels the power roll onward out of sight as it passes beyond the nearest buildings and into the East River. It's done. And as Manny climbs off the cab's hood and settles back onto the ground, once again he feels something waft through him, from the soles of his shoes to the roots of his hair. It's the same energy, he realizes, that suffused the cab when it torpedoed through the tendril mass, and which soothed him at Penn Station, and which guided him from there to here. That energy is the city, he understands somehow. And it is part of him, filling him up and driving out anything unnecessary to make room for itself. That's why his name is gone. The energy begins to fade. Will his memory come back when it's done? No way to know. Though Manny feels he should be frightened by this realization, he isn't. It doesn't make sense. Amnesia, even if it's temporary, can't be a good thing. He might have a brain bleed, some kind of hidden injury. He should go to a hospital. But instead of being frightened, he is actually comforted by the presence of the city within him. He shouldn't be. He has an inkling that he just had a near-death experience. But he is. The East River churns at his back. He looks up at the towering breadth of Manhattan. Endless high-rise co-ops. Repurposed banks, cramped housing projects, sandwiched between ancient theater houses and soulless corporate headquarters. Nearly 2 million people. He's been here 1 hour, but already he feels like he has never lived anywhere else. And even if he doesn't know who he was, he knows who he is. "I'm Manhattan," he murmurs softly. And the city replies without words, right into his heart. "Welcome to New York." Chapter 2. Showdown in the Last Forest. Madison drops Manny off up in Inwood.
"It's a way out of my way," she says as he hauls his bag out of the car. "But there's a great empanada place around here that I like. Anyway, I think my cab likes you."
She strokes its broad old real leather dash, as if petting a horse.
"This thing's engine is gas-guzzling shit, but it ran smoother on the way up here than it ever has before. Maybe running over semi-visible sea monsters is good for the spark plugs or something."
Manny laughs at her through the open passenger window.
"Well, I'll be sure to call you and your cab to help next time, too," he says.
Because there is going to be a next time, he feels certain.
Thanks, no, pass," she says.
Then she tilts her head to the side and gives him a once-over so frank that Manny finds himself blushing. It ends with her grin and wink.
"You ever want to consider a different kind of ride, though? Call Checker Cab Dream Weddings and ask for me."
Manny can't help chuckling, though it's awkward. He doesn't think he's used to such aggressive flirting. She's pretty, and he's interested. But something makes him reluctant to take her up on the offer. What? He's not sure. Maybe it's just the fact that he seems to be transforming into the living embodiment of a major metropolitan area. And that's not an ideal time to start dating anyone. So he tries to make it kind, as brush-offs go, because it's not her, it's him.
I'll keep that in mind.
She grins, taking the rejection in stride, which makes him like her that much more. Then she pulls away from the curb, and there he is, alone in front of his new home. It's one of the older apartment buildings of Inwood, sprawling over half a block and with an actual garden out front, he notes as he walks through the wrought iron gates. Someone in the building has planted poppies and he thinks echinaceas. In the foyer, which is huge, there are black and white tiles on the floor and fancy cornices in marble along the walls. The ceiling is embossed tin buried beneath so many layers of paint that it looks lumpy. No doorman, but this isn't that kind of neighborhood. None of it feels familiar. The address was in his phone, thankfully, on a sticky app marked with New Addy, followed by barely legible finger-scrawled information. But he does not remember ever visiting New York before. What kind of person abbreviates address to Addy, he wonders. What kind of person is 3 exclamation points worth of excited about having a new address? Is that the sort of person who would rent an apartment and pick a roommate sight unseen? The sluggish, ancient elevator is the kind with an inner gate that must be pulled shut before the whole thing will move. On the top floor, the elevator doors open to reveal a hallway lit murkily by ancient fluorescence and stretching away into a distance that shouldn't be possible, given the length of New York City blocks. From within the elevator, it's eerie, like something out of a survival horror video game. As Manny steps out, however, something seems to swipe its way across his perception. When he blinks, the hallway light is brighter, its shadows reduced, its contrasts softened, and its faint scents, lingering food smells from someone's dinner, dust, paint, a whiff of cat piss, sharpened. Now, it's just a hallway. But it feels safer somehow than it did a moment before. Weird. Okay, then. 4J is the apartment number in his phone. Manny's got a key tagged with the same number, but he knocks just to be polite. There's a thump of hurried feet from beyond, and then the door opens, held by a lanky Asian guy who's got sleep lines all over one side of his face. But he brightens and spreads his arms at once.
Hey, roomie,
he says in a heavy British accent.
You made it!
Yeah, Manny says, grinning awkwardly. He has no idea who this man is.
Had some trouble on the FDR.
The FDR? Isn't that on the east side of the island? Why would your cab go that way from Penn? Was the traffic that bad? After that horror show at the Williamsburg? But the man ignores his own question in the next instant, stepping forward and grabbing Manny's suitcase.
Here, let me. Your boxes and other suitcase all got here a few days ago.
It's all so normal. Inside, the apartment is enormous, with a full-sized kitchen and 2 bedrooms that are nicely spaced from each other, one just past the living room, the other farther down the hall past the bathroom and a storage closet. His roommate has claimed the closer one, so Manny heads to the far end of the apartment to find a spacious room that features a full suite of bedroom furniture. Apparently, pre-amnesia Manny wanted a furnished space. There aren't any sheets on the bed, and there are dust bunnies in the corners, but it's nice. The window displays a great view of a commercial parking lot. He loves it.
See? Yeah,
says the roommate, watching him take it all in. It's a great flat, yeah? Just like the pictures I sent you. Pictures. He's the kind of guy who signs a lease based on pictures.
Yeah, perfect.
But he can't keep calling his roommate you. This is embarrassing, sorry, but your name? The man blinks, then laughs.
Bell? Bell Nguyen, PhD candidate in political theory at Columbia, just like you.
What, was the train ride that bad?
No,
it's a useful excuse. He evaluates its potential benefits and decides to deploy it.
Well, yeah, I had, I don't know, a fainting spell.
when I was getting off the train. My head's feeling a little... He waggles his fingers, hoping to convey confusion rather than delusion.
Oh, shit.
Belle looks honestly concerned for him.
You need anything? I could, maybe some good tea.
I brought some from home.
No, I'm okay,
Manny says quickly. Although all at once, he's not entirely sure of that. Here in the so ordinary place, as he thinks about what happened on the FDR drive, it seems less and less possible. If he's got amnesia, then maybe there's something genuinely wrong with him. Maybe he's been hit in the head. Maybe he's got early onset dementia. I mean, I feel okay. But there are things I'm having trouble remembering clearly.
Like my name?
Manny considers replying no, like mine, but decides against it. Discovering that one's roommate is actively undergoing a break with reality is high on the scale of things one wants to learn before signing the lease.
Among other things.
So, sorry in advance if I ask about things you've already told me.
Or if I tell you things you already know, like, my nickname.
Call me Manny. He's braced for pushback, but Belle only shrugs.
Manny it is. You want to change your name every week, mate?
Whatever, as long as the rent check's clear. He laughs at his own joke, then shakes his head and lets go of Manny's suitcase.
Sure you don't want that tea? It's not a bother. Or,
huh, I was thinking about going for a walk to get the lay of the land, so to speak. Join me, yeah? Fresh air might do you good.
It's eminently sensible.
Manny nods, and after a pause to dump his jacket and change into fresh jeans, he's just noticed the streaks on his khakis from sitting on the taxi's roof. They head out. The apartment building is only a few blocks from Inwood Hill Park. The park is gigantic, Manny remembers seeing on a map somewhere. He seems to have no trouble remembering general facts, he notes clinically. Only things specific to his own life elude him. It's also the last untouched bit of an old-growth forest that once covered the entire island of Manhattan. It mostly looks like any other park on first impression. Paved pathways, ironwork fences, benches, tennis courts, and the occasional dog walker, complete with leashed, yapping coterie. Surprisingly empty, although that's likely a factor of it being the middle of the day on a weekday when most people are at work or school. Past the manicured bit of mowed lawn and decorative trees, Manny beholds a forested hill rising above all, covered in a dense tangle of trees and shrubs that clearly have never seen a backhoe or road grader. He stares at this, astounded that it exists less than 5 miles from the lights and bluster of Broadway. While Belle inhales, his eyes shut in palpable bliss.
Oh, this is why I wanted to live up here.
Well, that and the fact that I couldn't afford anywhere else on the island. He grins at Manny and resumes walking down the path. Manny does too, turning to take in the sights.
Worse than London proper, this place. But then I read about this. A forest in the middle of the bloody city. I knew it was right for me. Spent a couple of summers up at Hack Four Wood in North Yorkshire back when I was a sprog. Near my grandmother's house.
His face falls a little, and something in his tone flattens.
Of course she disowned me when I turned out to be a bloke in progress instead of a girl. So I haven't been back for ages.
Sorry to hear that, Manny says. And then he registers more than the pain in the words. He blinks at Belle in his surprise. He's got the sense not to say anything. But Belle catches the glance, and his expression immediately goes neutral.
Forgot that too, then. This where you suddenly recall you don't really want to live with a trans fellow after all.
Then Manny realizes how his amnesia story must sound. He can't think of anything to offer except honesty.
I did forget.
But if I want it out, I'd have made up a better lie than this one.
Well, way to impress his roommate with his pathological tendencies. But the statement surprises Bell into a laugh, though there's still a bitter edge to it. He does relax just a little.
I suppose that's true enough. And you do seem different, somehow, from the chap I met on Skype last month.
Annie tries not to tense. He focuses on the asphalt beneath their feet as they walk.
Oh?
Yeah, hard to say how. Bell shrugs.
To be honest, I was a bit worried about you.
You seemed nice enough, but there was an edge to you. Back home, a lot of queer cis blokes just as ready to kick my ass as the straights, yeah? And something about you felt like an ass-kicker extraordinaire. But you said we weren't going to have a problem and I wasn't spoiled for choice, so... He sighs.
Oh.
We aren't going to have a problem, Manny says again, as reassuringly as he can. At least not about that. You put dirty socks in the fridge, though, and all bets are off. Bell laughs again. And just like that, the air is cleared.
I'll take care with my socks, then. No promises on the hats.
They both fall silent as ambulances race past the entrance of the park. They're pretty far along the walking path by now, but three ambulances in full siren aren't going to be ignorable no matter how thick the blanket of trees surrounding them.
It's still Manhattan, after all.
Bell grimaces in their wake.
Heard they were calling in emergency personnel from the whole, what do you call it, tri-state area for this mess?
God.
I can't wait to see which entire ethnic group they're going to scapegoat in the wake of this one.
Maybe it's a white guy again. A lone wolf with mental health issues, right?
Maybe.
Well, hopefully. So they won't use it as an excuse for more hate crimes. Or new wars or any of that.
Fuck, what a thing to hope for.
Manny nods. And there's nothing good either of them can think of to say after this. So they fall into a companionable silence thereafter. It's a soothing walk, Manny finds, though just about anything would be soothing after the past couple of hours. More significantly, the park feels right. Like the checker cab, like the people who helped him at Penn Station, like his own inexplicable sense of belonging within this city that feels so strange and alive. His memory loss is weirdly selective. He remembers going to cities that have this same weird vibrancy before. Paris, Cairo, Tokyo. None of them, however, felt made for him. It is as if every other place he's visited or lived has been a vacation. And only now has he come home. At one juncture of paths, there's a map. Manny's marveling at the sheer size of the park when his gaze catches on the words Inwood Park Tulip Tree. In the same moment, Bell steps forward and puts a finger to the icon, leaning close to read the nigh microscopic text nearby.
According to legend, he reads, on this site of the principal Manhattan Indian village, Peter Minuit in 1626, purchased Manhattan Island for trinkets and beads, then worth about 60 guilders. And apparently a big tree grew there too, but it died in 1932. Ah, so this is where your ancestors began the whole business of stealing the country.
He chuckles and imitates Eddie Izzard.
Do you have a flag? No? That'll be one island then, keep the change. And we'll kick in some free smallpox and syphilis.
Manny's skin is a prickle all over. Why? He doesn't know, but he speaks automatically, unable to take his eyes off the map icon.
I think the apocalyptic plagues actually started a couple of centuries earlier. Columbus?
Right,
1492, sailing the ocean blue. Bell steps back and stretches.
Seems a good break point. Want to go look at this extremely important rock, then head back?
Sure, Manny says.
He has a feeling it's more important than it sounds.
The extremely important rock isn't far from the park entrance, over near where a vast meadow edges Spuytendyvil Creek. As monuments go, it's unassuming, Manny notes as they approach it. Just a boulder that's about waist high, surrounded by a circle of bare dirt and a ring of grimy concrete. It's positioned at a juncture of several paved paths, with a nice view of the creek and a high, narrow bridge that probably leads to the Bronx, or maybe that's Queens. There are a few people around. He can see an old man in the distance, feeding pigeons as he sits on a park bench, and a young couple having a romantic picnic on the overgrown lawn a good ways off. Otherwise, though, they're alone. He and Belle stop by the rock for a while, reading the plaque that names the spot Shirokopok, after the name of the village that was displaced. Or maybe that's the name of the long-gone tree. The plaque isn't clear. Belle sits on the rock and clones for a moment by trying to cross his legs and meditate on the energies while Manny laughs. The laugh is a little forced, because there are definite energies here, strange and palpable as the umbrella became on FDR Drive. And he really has no idea what that means. Then again, he recalls, the umbrella wasn't the source of the strange power he used, or at least not the sole source. The power had come into the umbrella because it was everywhere, floating through the air and flowing along the asphalt of the city. And Manny just used the right combination of things, ideas, to summon it forth. A car, in that place of choking exhaust and whipping curves and potholes, that had been utterly necessary. Movement, too, that had been part of what made the power come. In the city that never sleeps, FDR is the highway that never stops, except for occasional accidents and traffic jams. Is the power dependent on context, then? Manny folds his arms, staring at the rock, and wondering what secrets it holds.
Ow, Belle says as he gets off the rock. History hurts. Whose bloody idea was it to put a rock on this spot? How's that supposed to commemorate anything? Americans like statues. What's wrong with a statue?
Someone was being cheap.
Cheap.
Manny blinks. There's something in that word. A tickle of a thought. He nods absently when Belle says something about getting dinner, trying to tease out that tickle. But then he catches a sudden sharp note in Belle's voice.
What's this now?
It pulls Manny out of introspection, and he turns to see that a woman is walking toward them. She's portly, short, white with a florid complexion, and dressed for office work. Nondescript. There's no reason for Manny or Belle to pay attention to her, in fact, except that she's got a cell phone in one hand, upraised toward them. Its camera light is on. The woman stops, still filming them.
Gross, she says. I can't believe you two. Right out in the open? I'm calling the cops.
Belle glances at Manny, who shakes his head in confusion. He has no idea what she's talking about either.
Oi,
Belle says. His accent has shifted, a little less BBC generic and a little more South London. Somehow Manny knows this, and his expression has gone hard.
You're recording us, love, without asking? That's a bit rude, isn't it? Rude is people being perverts in public,
the woman replies, doing something on her phone that looks like zooming in. It's pointed at Manny's face as she does this, and he doesn't like it one bit. He resists the urge to turn away or reach for her phone, however, since that seems likely to only incite further rudeness on her part. He does step forward.
What exactly do you think?
She reacts as if his single step forward was a full-on bull charge, gasping and mincing back several steps.
Don't touch me! Don't touch me! If you lay a finger on me, I'll scream and the cops will shoot you, you druggies, druggy perverts!
Pervert or alone, maybe, but druggy? Bell has shifted to put a hand on his hip, expression skeptical.
I'll have you know I'm straight edge. You sure you haven't been overindulging on the Percocet yourself, love? You're definitely seeing things.
He waves a hand in front of her phone. She jerks it back and dances off to one side. At which point, Manny begins to wonder if he's seeing things. Because as the woman turns her back toward Manny, he notices that there is something jutting up from the back of her neck through the tangle of her loose bun. It's long and thin, somewhere between the thickness of a hair and a pencil. And as he stares, it moves just a little. Its tip flicks once fitfully, when there is no wind, toward Manny, then back up into the air. He narrows his eyes, and it trembles as if the force of his gaze has disturbed it. It flicks again, toward him and away. Manny goes still, overwhelmed by an epiphany of familiarity. His thoughts are startled word salad, but those words are cordyceps, puppet strings, drinking straw, and more coherently, that thing on the FDR drive. He drags his gaze from the white thing sticking out of the woman's neck to her face. That's not who you really are, he says. Show yourself. Bell frowns at him. The woman turns to him, inhaling and opening her mouth to complain again, and then she goes still. It's the stillness of a bad freeze frame, catching her mid-inhalation and before the expression on her face can settle into either contempt or anger, leaving it interstitially vacant for a moment. She hasn't put down the camera, but her thumb must have gone slack. The recording light flicks off.
The fuck?
Bell says, now staring at her. Manny blinks, and in the nanosecond that his eyes are shut, the woman's clothing turns entirely white. The suit, the shoes, even the pantyhose, her hair too, which abruptly makes her look like a cross between a church lady and a female Colonel Sanders. She starts moving again, chuckling at Manny and Belle's obvious discomfiture, and then raising her free hand to waggle in a ta-da gesture. What a relief, she declares. Her voice has changed. It's lower now, alto rather than soprano. Around this voice, her smile is all teeth and nearly manic. It's hard enough to act like one of you people already, but pretending that I didn't know you was getting old. It's good to see you again, Sao Paulo. Every place feels the same in this universe. Your directions twist in and out like holes through cheese. But aren't you a little out of place? I remember the taste of your blood being a little farther south. She's looking at Bell. What? Bell says. He looks at Manny. Manny shakes his head in denial, not confusion. He gets what's happening, though he doesn't want to get it. That white thing sticking out of her head. Antenna is another of the words that have risen to the top of his mind. The white thing is like a receiver, channeling someone else's voice and thoughts and image from elsewhere. How do I know this? He thinks in a momentary, not quite panic. I am Manhattan, comes the answer, which has its own questionish baggage. He'll ponder it later. The woman, meanwhile, is peering narrowly at Bell, as if she's having trouble seeing him, even though he's right there. She glances at the camera as if to confirm what her eyes are seeing, then lowers the camera. Are you? And her head tilts. Not who I think you are. Are you something else? Underneath that covering? Bell stiffens perceptibly. Who I am is none of your fucking business, woman. You want to move along, or shall I move you?
Oh, you're just human. Pardon me, I mistook you for 15 million other people. You, though.
She turns her gaze on Manny, and he sees then that her eyes have changed color, too. They were brown, but something has faded them to a brown so pale that they verge on yellow. It's difficult to stare at those eyes and not think of predators like wolves or raptors, but Manny makes himself do so, because predators attack when one shows weakness.
You definitely aren't human.
Manny manages not to flinch, but she laughs as if she's sensed the aborted nerve impulse.
Well, I knew you had to go to ground somewhere after our battle. Here, though, a forest?
Trying to air out the reek of the trash you've slept under.
What?
Manny frowns in confusion. The woman blinks, then frowns back, her eyes narrowing.
I was pretty sure I'd hurt you. Broken some bones, but you seem intact. To the degree that your species can be, and...
Abruptly her head tilts, belligerence giving way to confusion.
You're cleaner than you should be.
Even your smell is... She trails off.
She's crazy!
But Manny knows, because of that awful white thing jutting from the back of her neck, that crazy is an inappropriate, incomplete word for what he's witnessing. It's impossible not to see that thing and understand that somehow this woman is affiliated with the giant mass of tendrils on FDR Drive.
Maybe this is what happens to the people whose cars picked up tendrils in passing. If they touch a person, that person is then compromised in some fundamental metaphysical infectious way. Whatever is speaking to Manny right now through this woman is not present. But that means there's something out there broadcasting tentacle monster TV. And this woman's got her own direct high-speed cable connection to it.
So what are you? Manny decides to ask. She snorts, though she keeps staring at him without blinking. It's creepy.
No small talk, just right to business.
No wonder everyone thinks New Yorkers are rude.
But no bluster either this time. Where is all of your...
She looks away for an instant, her eyes flickering, as if scanning some invisible dictionary, and then her gaze returns.
Shit-talking, yes. Where has all your shit-talking gone?
Manny tries not to use profanity if he can help it.
We've never met.
Untrue, untrue. She raises a hand and points at him, her eyes wide. He has a momentary flashback to his childhood, seeing syndicated repeats of Invasion of the Body Snatchers with Donald Sutherland. And it is entirely too easy to envision this woman with staring alien eyes screaming at him. But then she frowns again.
You aren't injured, though.
Has your shape changed? I didn't think your species could do that, except slowly, growing old and such.
Manny, mate, Bell murmurs, having stepped closer to him while the woman babbled. This lady is clearly 13 short of a baker's dozen, and I'm a little freaked out by the instant bleach job.
Manny, the woman blurts before Manny can reply. She looks from Bell to him and back to Bell.
His name is Manny.
Shit, Bell says. Sorry, shouldn't have used your name.
Don't worry about it.
Manny keeps his gaze on the woman, so he sees it when she inhales, and all at once her face distorts. For an instant, she is very not human, her eyes flashing from yellowy brown into glaring white, and her cheekbones seeming to shift and multiply under the skin of her face. And then her expression settles into a bright, manic-eyed grin.
Manhattan,
she breathes. He shivers with the pull of it. There is power in the way she speaks his name.
power that she seems to know how to use in ways that he does not yet. And this frightens him.
So does the avid, greedy Melis in her unstable eyes. You are Manhattan, where money talks and bullshit walks. Do you never sleep, young man? I see you aren't wearing silk and satin.
Manny tries not to let the nonsense confuse him. What matters is he faces an adversary who radiates danger. How does one fight spectral alien sea tentacles in human form? He has no umbrella here, no antique cab, nothing but the Shirokapuk rock, which he doesn't know how to use. On FDR, he followed his instincts, and they eventually led him to the solution. Keep her talking, his instincts say no. So he obeys again. On FDR, he says, meeting the woman's bright-eyed gaze, I killed your creature with an umbrella, or... He amends himself, as intuition flutters at the back of his mind. Not your creature. You? Just a little bit of me, a toe to hold. She lifts a foot, which is clad in a simple white leather ballet flat, and waggles the toe. Her ankles are swollen. Too much time sitting at a desk, Manny guesses, and apparently being possessed by monsters from the beyond does nothing for the circulation. I'd expected to lose that toehold, the woman continues with a long-suffering sigh. She turns and starts pacing, clutching the cell phone to her breast with a melodramatic sigh. We usually do. When new entities actualize or mature or whatever you call it. And we did lose it later. Someone came along and stubbed our toe, damn it. Such a vicious little thing he was. Positively thuggish. And after he was done with me and I lay bleeding and hating in the cold depths between, I found that my toe still held. Just a little. Just one toe. In just one place. FDR Drive, Manny says, his skin prickles with chill. FDR Drive. Until you tore even that toehold loose. That was you, wasn't it? You people all look alike to me, but I smell it now. Like him. But not. Her head tilts from one side to the other as she says this. It is a gesture that feels both contemplative and contemptuous. Too late, of course. Before you ever got there, I'd infected quite a few cars. Now we have hundreds of toes all over the tri-state area. She bounces a little on the balls of her feet, then frowns down at herself, as if annoyed by her momentary paucity of toes. In Manny's mind, fountains of tentacles are erupting on highways and bridges throughout a 100-mile radius. He tries not to let her see how much this idea frightens him. What does it mean? What are they doing? What will they do once they've infected enough cars and people and... What the fuck are you talking about? Asks Bill. She rolls her eyes. The politics of space-time fractionality and superpositioning! She snaps, before dismissing Belle again and sighing at Manny. Belle just stares at her. Well, you're obviously part of that other one, which means that you have four more bodies out there somewhere. Four more, oh, what do you people call those? Organs? She stops abruptly, frowning to herself, then rounds on Belle and points west. You, human, what is that? After a deeply worried glance at Manny, Belle follows her gesture to Spuytendyvil Creek. She's pointing past it, actually, at a dramatic-looking cliff beyond which is dotted with houses and condo buildings. Westchester, Belle suggests. Ooh, maybe the Bronx? I wouldn't know, I've only been here a couple of weeks. The Bronx? The woman's lip curls. Yes. That's one. Manhattan is another.
The one I fought, he is the heart. But you others are the head and limbs and such. He was strong enough to fight us even without you, but not strong enough to stand after. Not strong enough to push me out now. Thus does the toehold become an entire foot. In spite of everything, Manny is actually beginning to understand. Burrows, he murmurs in wonder. I am Manhattan. You're talking about the burrows of the city. You're saying I really am Manhattan. And you're saying there are others. The woman stops pacing and turns, too slowly to study him again. You didn't know that until just now, she says, her gaze narrowing. Manny goes still. He knows he's made a mistake by showing his hand, but only time will reveal how bad a mistake it was. Five of you, says the woman in white in satisfaction. Like that. Something in Manny's brain adjusts the designation into capital letter status. The woman in white. She's smiling, and it's cold. Five of you, and only poor Sao Paulo to look after you all. He's with the one I fought. You're alone, and you don't know what you're doing at all, do you? Manny's stomach has knotted with fear. He can tell she's about to do something. And he still has no idea how to fight her. What do you want? He asks to stall her, to buy time to think. She shakes her head and sighs. Oh, it would probably be sporting to tell you, but there's no sport in this for me. I just have a job to do. Goodbye, Manhattan. All at once, she's gone. The woman in white, that is. Between one blink and another, the white woman's clothes and hair flicker back into their ordinary tints. She slumps a little, just an ordinary brown-eyed woman again. But after a moment of confusion, the woman's lips tighten, and she raises her cell phone again. The camera light goes back on. But something worse is happening. When the hairs on the back of Manny's neck prickle, he jumps and wheels around, suddenly convinced that someone is coming at him from behind. He sees the forgotten young couple on the lawn, still picnicking. But otherwise, there's nothing there. Wait. No. Rising from cracks and spars in the asphalt of the path are ghostly little white nubs. Manny grabs Bell and yanks him back just as white nubs rise through a crack he'd been standing on. More wriggle through even the unbroken portions of the asphalt. When Manny sees that no white nubs are rising from the narrow ring of bare soil that surrounds the tulip tree rock, and perhaps another 3 or 4 inches beyond that, Manny pulls them both to stand within this apparently protected circle. What-a, Bell begins. Bell can clearly perceive the white nubs Manny is relieved to see. At least he doesn't have to explain this, too. Bell backs himself against the rock, looking around in horror as the nubs become inchworms. It's just disgusting, says the woman. She stands amid an ankle-high lawn of the tendrils now, and the one coming from the back of her neck has fissioned into two, both of them uncannily oriented on Manny. Incredibly through all this, she's still recording them, or not just recording. An instant later, a voice crackles from the phone's speaker. Manny can't make it out, but he hears the woman say, I need the police. There are these two guys in Inwood Hill Park who are, I don't know, menacing people. I think they're drug dealers, and they won't leave. Also, they're having sex. Listen, woman, I don't think you know what sex looks like, Bell splutters. In the distance, the young couple giggles, though Manny doesn't think it's because of what Bell said. They're busy making out and haven't noticed what's happening by the rock. The woman ignores Bell, intent on her conversation. Yes, I will. I'm recording them. Right, She hesitates, then screws up her face and adds,
African-American. Or maybe Hispanic, I can't tell.
I'm obviously British Asian, you stupid bint.
Belle stares at her open-mouthed. Meanwhile, however, the tendrils are still growing and getting long enough that they're going to be able to touch Belle and Manny, even if they climb on top of the rock, which probably isn't going to help, since the rock isn't big enough for two people to stand on. Which reminds Manny that the rock is meaningful, an object of power, somehow.
Shirokapok, site of the first real estate swindle of the soon-to-be New York.
What can he do with that?
Oh.
Oh!
He pushes at Belle. Get up on the rock, he says. I need the room. And give me whatever's inside your wallet.
It's a measure of how freaked out Belle is that he complies, scrabbling onto the rock and groping for his back pocket.
Worst mugging ever, mate, he quips with a shaking voice.
Manny has pulled his own wallet out of his pocket. He finds himself remarkably calm as he opens it and rummages for something that will serve that tickle of an idea in his mind. And a detached, analytical part of him contemplates this lack of fear. He should be terrified, after seeing what these tendrils have done to another human being. What will it be like to have his body invaded and his mind overtaken by whatever entity these things serve?
Like dying, he decides.
And since some part of him has faced death before, he is aware of that. Suddenly, it's why he's so calm. Manny also decides that he's not going out like that. There's not much in his wallet. Some receipts, a $5 bill, an Amex card, a debit card, an expired condom. No photos of loved ones, which will strike him as odd only later. An ID. But immediately he tears his eyes away from this, not wanting to see the name he had prior to this morning's train ride. Who he used to be is irrelevant. Right now, he needs to be Manhattan. The instant his fingers touch one of the credit cards, he feels a flicker of that strange energy and focus that he had on the FDR. Yes, land has value, he murmurs to himself, distracted from the rising whipping field of white all around him. Even public land, like in a park. It's just a concept, land ownership. We don't have to live like this, but this city in its current form is built on that concept.
Please tell me you aren't losing it, Belle says from where he's crouched on the rock. I don't think both of us can afford a psychotic break at the same time. We just signed a lease.
Manny looks up at him and tosses the fiver to the ground just beyond the rock's ring. He feels, rather than hears, a sudden hollow, high-pitched squealing from where the bill has landed. And he knows without looking what has happened. Where the bill has touched the asphalt, it has hurt the tendrils and caused the ones in that immediate area to withdraw. Belle stares at this. Frantically, he pulls a handful of disordered bills out of his wallet. Some of them are euros, some British pounds, U.S. bills, and a few pesos. Clearly, Belle travels a lot. He tosses one of the pound notes. It lands not far from the bill Manny threw, but nothing happens.
I told you to give it to me, Manny says, snatching the wad of bills from Belle's shaking fingers.
Doing this strengthens the strange feeling. Manhattan was built not only on land valuation, but stolen value.
Just trying to help with his bollocks, Belle snaps. God, do whatever nonsense you have to do. They're getting closer.
Manny starts casting the bills around the edge of the field of white, make it rain style. He quickly sees that the money is having an effect, but not much of one. A 5-pound note clears the space underneath it, but no more. And he loses sight of it after a moment, amid the surrounding field of tendrils. The euros and pounds work, too, but it seems to depend on their value. $100 bill clears not only its own space, but an inch or so around itself. €100 note clears slightly more, but all of it together adds up to only enough space to keep the nearer tendrils from being able to reach Manny. And if the tendrils keep growing, they'll eventually be able to reach Manny,
no matter how many additional inches of land he's gained. That's it. Suddenly, Manny understands. He is effectively buying the land around the tulip tree rock. But it costs a lot more than 60 guilders now. Belle, do you know how much Manhattan real estate runs per square foot?
Are you actually insane?
One of the taller tendrils whips toward Manny's thigh, and he swats at it with a $20 bill. It squeals and withdraws. I really need to know. Please.
How the bloody fuck should I know? I'm a flat renter, not a buyer. Maybe $1,000 a foot? $2,000?
That's the problem, then, Manny realizes with a bitter groan. Manhattan real estate is horrifically expensive, and they don't have enough cash to buy their own lives. In desperation, he tosses his Amex, and that has the biggest effect yet, clearing a rectangular chunk of space